Welcome to a chilling exploration of the human psyche at its most enigmatic. In this video, we delve into the most haunting last wishes of those sentenced to death. A window into the minds of individuals who faced final judgment for their crimes. With 11 chilling stories that traverse the realms of remorse, defiance, and curiosity, we peer into the final requests of those who walk the dark path of crime and punishment. John Henry Ramirez. The murder of John Henry Ramirez was a chilling act of violence that shocked the community of Corpus Christi, Texas in 2004. On that fateful day, Ramirez, then 38 years old, committed a gruesome murder that would haunt the memories of many. He attacked Pablo Castro, 46, a convenience store worker, as he took out the trash. In a horrific and senseless act, Ramirez slit Castro's throat and stabbed him 29 times. His motive was just $25. This brutal murder came amidst a series of robberies perpetrated by Ramirez and two women after a three-day drug binge. The heinous nature of the crime left scars not only on the victim's family, but also on the collective conscience of the community. It was a crime that demanded justice, and for years the pursuit of that justice would be intertwined with legal battles and delays. Over time, as the legal process dragged on, John Henry Ramirez underwent something of a transformation. His case would redefine the role of spiritual advisors on death rows across the country. Once a perpetrator of unimaginable violence, Ramirez found solace and redemption in his faith. In March, the U.S. Supreme Court made a landmark decision ruling in Ramirez's favor. The court affirmed that states must respect the religious wishes of death row inmates by allowing their religious leaders to pray for them and touch them during their executions. The decision marked a significant shift in how the justice system treated the final moments of the condemned. As his execution date approached, Ramirez clung to his newfound faith and had one final wish. His dying request was to kneel in prayer before facing the ultimate punishment. It was a poignant and deeply personal request, a final plea for spiritual solace and reconciliation. On the day of his execution, in the cold, shadowy confines of the death chamber at Hansville State Penitentiary, Ramirez's spiritual advisor, Dan, stood by his side. With quiet intensity, Murr placed his right hand on Ramirez's chest and held it there. The courtroom fell into a profound silence as Murr recited a brief, heartfelt prayer. "Look upon John with your grace," he implored. "Grant him peace. Grant us all peace." As Moore concluded his prayer, Ramirez responded with a solemn amen. After this profound moment of prayer and reflection, Ramirez turned to address the family of his victim, Pablo Castro, who watched through a window a few feet away. He spoke words of regret and remorse, acknowledging the heinous act he had committed. "I hope this brings some comfort to you," he said, his voice filled with a mixture of pain and regret. "If this helps you, then I'm glad. I hope this helps you find closure in some small way." In his final moments, John Henry Ramirez expressed his love for his wife, his son, and his friends. He said with determination, "Just so you know, I've fought a good fight and I'm ready to go." As the lethal dose of pentobarbital began to take effect, Ramirez took several deep breaths and then an eerie silence fell as he began to snore. Within a minute, all movement ceased. John Henry Ramirez was pronounced dead 14 minutes later at 6:41 p.m. Central Daylight Saving Time. His journey from a perpetrator of violent acts to a man seeking solace in his faith and his final act of kneeling prayer serve as a reflection on the complexities of human nature, redemption, and the evolving practices of the criminal justice system. Gene Hawthorne. The case of Gene Hawthorne is a chilling and disturbing story of domestic violence, murder, deception, and an unusual final plea that garnered widespread attention. Gene Hawthorne was on death row for the brutal murders of three members of her family in October 1984. Jan Hawthorne and her accomplice James Lee Byathard hatched a sinister plan to eliminate members of Hawthorne's family and secure a hefty $150,000 settlement. Their victims included Gene's father, Gene Sr., his wife Linda, and their teenage son Marcus. Their intention was to clear the way for their inheritance, but they were unaware that Gene Sr. had changed his will, disinheriting January Jr. In an attempt to divert suspicion, Jan Hawthorne scattered African-American human hair and placed cigarette butts near the crime scene. However, investigations eventually revealed her involvement in the murders, leading to her arrest and subsequent murder charges. During the trial, Jan Hatton attempted to pin the blame on his accomplice, James Lee Beathard, claiming that Beathard was solely responsible for the murders, while he himself had fired the shot through a window. Beathard, in a separate trial, was also found guilty and subsequently executed, maintaining his innocence to the end. Gene Hawthorne, however, continued to maintain his innocence and appealed his conviction. His legal team argued that the 1985 trial failed to take into account the mistreatment he suffered at the hands of his father, which allegedly fueled his hatred for his family. What sets Gene Hawthorne's case apart is his disturbing final request. As he faced the prospect of execution, he made an unusual request. He asked that his body be turned into fish food and fed to goldfish as part of an art installation if his appeal failed. This bizarre request was intended as a broader commentary on capital punishment and gave his consent to Julian Bourne's artist, Marco Everesti, to carry out this macabre plan. Everesti planned to freeze Gene's body and turn it into fish food, to be fed to goldfish as part of an art exhibit. Fortunately for Gene Hatton, her appeal was successful and her sentence was reduced to 3 life sentences. Consequently, her grotesque plea was dropped. The case of Gene Hatton remains a haunting reminder of the complexity and darkness of human behavior, especially in the context of domestic violence and the criminal justice system. Frank Atwood. The Frank Wood case is a harrowing tale that unfolds against the backdrop of a heartbreaking crime and a deeply disturbing final plea. At the center of this story is a man convicted of the 1984 kidnapping and murder of Vicki Lynn Hoskinson, an 8-year-old girl in the state of Arizona. The details of this case are chilling. In the chilly September of 1984, young Vicki Lynn Hoskinson disappeared from her home in Tucson, Arizona. Her innocent purpose was to deposit a simple piece of paper in a nearby mailbox. Tragically, this mundane task led to his disappearance and death. The scattering of his lifeless body in the unforgiving desert months later shocked the community and left an indelible scar. At the center of this nightmare was Frank Atwood, a man convicted of the most heinous of crimes, the kidnapping and murder of a young girl. His conviction for first-degree murder resonated with the collective horror of a community that had lost its innocence. Frank Atwood's journey through the judicial system was marked by twists and turns that spanned decades. Judge John Hawkins, who presided over the case, wasted no time in delivering a guilty verdict. The chilling nature of Atwood's crime left no room for doubt. He was swiftly sentenced to the maximum penalty, execution within 2 months. However, a dark cloud of uncertainty hung over the execution process in Arizona during this period. An incident during the execution of another inmate had brought to light the horrific flaws in the lethal injection procedure, prompting a moratorium on executions. As a result, Atwood's life was spared, albeit temporarily. He remained on death row for over 30 years, his fate hanging in the balance as the legal system grappled with the complexities of capital punishment. Frank Wood's final request added a deeply disturbing layer to an already unsettling tale. Faced with the choice of dying by lethal injection or lethal gas, Atwood chose the latter option. However, he deviated from the norm by requesting nitrogen gas instead of the state-approved cyanide gas. Nitrogen gas was an unconventional option that ventured into uncharted territory in the realm of execution methods. However, his request was not granted. Instead, on a fateful day in June 2022, Atwood met his end by lethal injection at the age of 66. In his final moments, Atwood, who had found solace in the Greek Orthodox Church during his time in prison, was accompanied by a priest. His final words were imbued with an eerie sense of resignation and hope in divine mercy. The case of Frank Atwood is a somber and thought-provoking reminder of the complexities inherent in the criminal justice system, particularly in matters involving the death penalty. Wood's unconventional request for a different method of execution shed light on the ethical and practical challenges that continue to surround capital punishment in the United States, leaving an indelible mark on the annals of criminal justice history. Thomas Douglas Arthur. Thomas Douglas Arthur, known as Tommy, was a central figure in a long and complex legal saga that culminated in his execution. His story is chilling, marked by allegations of murder for hire and a steadfast insistence on his innocence. Here are the key elements of his case. Thomas Arthur's legal odyssey began with his conviction for the 1982 murder of Troy Wicker in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. The case took a sinister turn when it emerged that Troy's wife, Judy Wicker, had claimed to have hired Arthur to carry out the murder. She alleged that she had paid him $10,000 to kill her husband following an extramarital affair. Adding to Arthur's criminal record was a previous conviction in 1977 for the murder of his sister-in-law in Marion County. Arthur openly admitted to this crime but steadfastly maintained that he was not involved in Troy Wicker's death. His attorney suggested that Judy Wicker had falsely accused Arthur in an attempt to avoid the death penalty and secure parole. Thomas Arthur's legal journey was marked by a series of twists and turns. His initial conviction for the murder of Troy Wicker was overturned, as was a subsequent conviction. However, in 1991, Arthur was convicted for a third time, and his conviction was upheld. Over the years, he clung to his claim of innocence despite the weight of the evidence against him. What sets Arthur apart is the sheer number of times he faced scheduled executions only to have them stayed. He was, in a sense, an illegal Udin, narrowly escaping the final punishment time and time again. His execution dates in 2001, twice in 2007, 2008, 2012, 2015, and 2016 were all stayed just days before they were due to take place. As his final execution date approached in May 2017, Thomas Douglas Arthur made a plea that shocked the criminal justice system. He accepted his impending fate but asked not to be executed by lethal injection, citing a debilitating back injury that he claimed would make the process more painful and exacerbate his suffering. Instead, he made an unconventional request. He wanted to be executed by firing squad. This request was based on the belief that death by firing squad would be less painful and agonizing than lethal injection given his physical condition. Despite the disturbing nature of this request, the court did not grant it. On May 26, 2017, at the age of 75, Thomas Douglas Arthur was executed by lethal injection in Alabama, marking the end of a legal saga that had spanned more than three decades. The case of Thomas Douglas Arthur stands as a stark example of the complexities and controversies surrounding the death penalty in the United States, from multiple convictions to last-minute appeals to a final petition challenging the standards for execution methods. It remains a haunting chapter in the annals of criminal justice history. James Edward Smith. James Edward Smith, born in 1952 in Kentucky, led a dark life that culminated in a grisly crime and a bizarre final request before his execution. Here are the details of his criminal history and his unusual final moments. In March 1983, James Edward Smith, armed and masked, entered the office of Union Life Insurance Company in Texas. His intention was to rob the establishment. He confronted Deborah Renee Wilson, who was counting money at the counter. Smith demanded all the money, escalating the situation with his loaded pistol. Deborah Renee Wilson, in a panic, sought refuge behind a filing cabinet. Larry Don Rojus, the district manager, then approached the counter and handed Smith the money as ordered. However, Smith was not satisfied and ordered Rojus to return to the counter. What followed was a tragic and senseless act of violence. Smith, seemingly without motive, shot Rojus in the upper left chest, killing him. Smith attempted to flee the scene but was stopped by the collective efforts of office workers and bystanders in a nearby parking lot. The stolen money was also recovered, and Smith was arrested and charged with murder. Smith's trial and court proceedings were marked by unusual and often adversarial behavior. He attempted to flee the courtroom during the trial but was quickly apprehended. In 1984, he was convicted of murder and sentenced to death. However, Smith's journey through the criminal justice system took a strange turn when it came to his appeals. His mother, Alex Hamilton, initially appealed his execution, claiming that he was not mentally competent. This led to a temporary reprieve. But in a strange twist, Smith, despite maintaining his innocence, expressed a strong desire to die. James Edward Smith's final request before his execution is what truly sets his story apart. He asked for Rotunda soil as his last meal. This request was deeply rooted in his belief in voodoo rituals. Smith believed that consuming this dirt would facilitate his reincarnation and allow his spirit to leave the material world. However, state authorities denied this unconventional request because it did not fit into the approved food options for condemned prisoners. On June 26, 1990, James Edward Smith was executed by lethal injection. In his final statement, Smith fervently proclaimed his innocence, stating that he had not killed anyone. Despite this claim, he did not plead for his life and refused any further legal representation. Instead, he expressed his willingness to die. Smith's parting words included a reference to the H. Krishna belief, suggesting that he had a complex spiritual journey that included voodoo rituals, black magic, and a stint as a voodoo priest. James Edward Smith's execution went ahead, despite the United States Supreme Court finding insufficient evidence to review his case. This unusual situation represented a departure from standard legal procedures. Smith's complex background, willingness to accept death, and strange dying wish contribute to the enigmatic and unsettling nature of his story. Victor Feger. Victor Harry Feger was a convicted murderer and a major figure in the history of the death penalty in the United States. Born in 1935, Victor Feger led a troubled life and eventually became a drifter. In the summer of 1960, he arrived in Dubuque, Iowa, where he rented a room in a boarding house. His criminal activities began when he telephoned the doctors listed alphabetically in the local yellow pages. This sinister search led him to Dr. Edward Bartels. Feger's criminal activities escalated dramatically when he kidnapped and murdered Dr. Bartels in Illinois. He lured the doctor away by falsely claiming that a woman needed medical attention. Dr. Bartels was found dead in a hayloft with a single gunshot wound to the head. Feger was later arrested in Birmingham, Alabama, while attempting to sell Dr. Bartels' car. Authorities believe that Feger's motive for killing Dr. Bartels was to obtain any medications the doctor might carry for treating his patients. Because Feger had transported his urine across state lines, federal charges were filed against him. In his defense, Feger fabricated a story about a Chicago drug addict he supposedly met in Dubuque as the real killer of Dr. Bartels. Feger claimed that he had killed the drug addict and dumped his body in the Mississippi River. However, authorities found no evidence to support this alleged accomplice. Feger was tried and convicted in federal court for his crimes and received the death penalty. He filed an appeal that was denied, leaving only President John F. Kennedy with the power to commute his sentence. Iowa Governor Harold Hughes, who opposed capital punishment, joined Feger's attorney in seeking clemency for him. However, President Kennedy was unmoved by his pleas, considering the crime so heinous that he denied his request. Feger was confined to the federal penitentiary in DeWalt, Kansas, but had to be returned to Iowa because DeWalt was not equipped to carry out executions at the time. On March 5, 1963, Feger was transferred to the Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison, Iowa, to await execution. During his 10 days on death row, he conducted himself as a model prisoner. For his last meal, Victor Feger made an unusual request. He asked for a single olive with the pit still inside. He told prison guards that he hoped an olive tree would sprout from his grave as a sign of peace. This request reflected his complex and unusual beliefs in the face of his impending execution. On March 15, 1963, Fieger was executed at Lewarka. Witnesses included an Associated Press reporter and Iowa House of Representatives member John Ely. Ely's presence at the execution contributed to his opposition to the death penalty, leading him to work for its abolition in Iowa in 1965. After the execution, authorities found the olive pit in a pocket of Fieger's suit. Victor Fieger's execution marked the end of an era in Iowa. It would be nearly four decades before the next federal execution in the United States, that of Timothy McVeigh in 2001. Iowa abolished capital punishment for all crimes in 1965 and has not reinstated it, making it one of 22 states in the United States that have completely abolished the death penalty as of 2020. William Bonning. William George Bonning, known as the Highway Killer or the Highway Strangler, was one of the most notorious American serial killers, infamous for his horrific and heinous crimes. Here's a summary of his crimes and his unusual last will and testament. Between May 1979 and June 1980, William Bonning committed a horrific series of crimes that included the rape, torture, and murder of at least 21 young women. His victims, ranging in age from 12 to 19, were predominantly Caucasian or Latino, often described as thin, pale, and with long hair. Bonning often targeted hitchhikers, schoolchildren, and prostitutes. His modus operandi was brutal. Bonning would lure or force his victims into his Ford Econoline van, where he would overpower them, bind their hands and feet with handcuffs and cables or ropes, sexually assault them, and repeatedly beat them in the face, torso, head, and genitals. He would then torture them before killing them. Strangulation with their own shirts and an iron bar was a common method of murder, although some victims were also stabbed or beaten to death. The level of brutality increased with each crime, reflecting Bonin's seemingly insatiable homicidal urges. Bond displayed a disturbing fascination with the suffering of his victims. He often described taking pleasure in hearing their screams and engaged in acts of violence, particularly sadistic ones, such as forcing victims to drink hydrochloric acid or impaling them with ice picks. He inflicted severe physical and psychological torment on his victims, revealing a chilling and sadistic nature. William Bonin's final request is both unusual and chilling. Facing his imminent execution by lethal injection at San Quentin State Prison on February 23, 1996, Bonnie requested a final meal consisting of two large pizzas, three pints of ice cream, and 3 6-packs of Coca-Cola. This final meal, marked by excessive amounts of sugary and indulgent foods, stood in stark contrast to the seriousness and gravity of his crimes. Bonin's choice of a gluttonous final meal is often seen as a clear reflection of his lack of remorse or understanding of the gravity of his actions. It serves as a grim reminder of the callousness and lack of empathy that characterized his personality throughout his life, even as he faced the ultimate punishment for his crimes. In his final interview, Bonnie expressed a lack of remorse for his actions, stating that he could not control his urge to kill and denying responsibility for his crimes. His statements and actions in the hours leading up to his execution portrayed a man unrepentant and disconnected from the immense suffering he had caused his victims and their families. Ayan Warnos. A name that sends shivers down the spine, Ayan Warnos rose to notoriety as one of America's most infamous serial killers. Her dark and disturbing rampage spanned the highways of Florida from 1989 to 1990. Warnos was no ordinary criminal. She was a female serial killer, a rarity in the world of serial murder. Her modus operandi was as brutal as it was chilling. She shot and robbed 7 of her male clients, all of whom were motorists and ranged in age from 40 to 65. In her account, Warnos alleged that her clients had inflicted unspeakable horrors on her, including rape, attempted rape, and other forms of sexual assault. According to her, the murders she committed were acts of self-defense, attempts to escape the clutches of her assailants. Her story of survival against predatory men became the stuff of macabre legend. The timeline of Warno's crimes reads like a grim chapter from a crime novel. Her first victim, Richard Charles Mallory, met a violent end on November 30, 1989. Warno's claimed that Mallory brutally assaulted her before taking her life. Her body was later found, riddled with bullets. The spree continued to claim more lives. David Andrew Spears disappeared in May 1990, only to be discovered shot 6 times in Citrus County. Charles Edmund Karskaden met an equally gruesome fate. His body, wrapped in an electric blanket, was shot 9 times with a .22 caliber weapon. Warno's crimes knew no bounds, even extending to Peter Abraham Sims, a retired merchant marine whose body has never been found. As the body count mounted, Troy Eugene Burrs became another victim, his body found in a wooded area off State Road 19 in Marion County. Charles Richard Dick Humphreys, a retired U.S. Air Force major and former child abuse investigator, was next to fall. His body was discovered in Marion County, fully clothed but with 7 gunshot wounds. Walter Sheno, Antonio, a truck driver, security guard, and reserve police officer, met a chilling end when his nearly naked body was located off a remote logging road in Dixie County. 5 days later, his car was found in Brevard County, a haunting reminder of the horrors that had occurred. Each crime added a layer of terror to Warno's story, a narrative she continued to shape, but her reign of terror was not destined to continue. On July 4, 1990, Warno's and his partner Tyra Moore abandoned Peter Sims' car after an accident. Rhonda Bailey, a witness to the incident, provided police with a description of the two women, sparking a media campaign to locate them. Warno's fingerprint against a pawn shop receipt eventually linked her to Sims' vehicle. Warno's was arrested on January 9, 1991. At the Last Resort Biker Bar in Virginia County, although Ball Joel alias Lori Grody. Her partner Tyria Moore was located the following day in Pennsylvania. In exchange for immunity from prosecution, Moore agreed to obtain a confession from Warno's. The story took a chilling turn when on January 16, 1991, Warno's confessed to the murders. She claimed that her male victims had raped her or attempted to, which formed the basis of her claim of self-defense. In November 1991, Warno's was legally adopted by Arlene Prale, a woman who had seen her picture in a newspaper. Warno's' trial was a harrowing spectacle. She was charged with the murder of Richard Charles Mallory. But the prosecution used Florida's Williams Rule to introduce evidence related to her other crimes, illustrating a pattern of illegal activity. Warno's was convicted of Mallory's murder with the help of Moe's testimony. Defense psychiatrists diagnosed her with borderline personality disorder and antisocial personality disorder, claiming she was mentally unstable. Throughout the trial, Warno's attempted to introduce evidence that Mallory had previously been convicted of attempted rape, but the judge refused to admit this history into evidence or grant a new trial. In the end, Warno's received 6 death sentences, one for each of her known victims. Her story was riddled with inconsistencies. She initially claimed that the 7 men had assaulted or attempted to assault her while she was working as a prostitute, but she later changed her story. In an interview with filmmaker Nick Brophield, Warno's confessed to acting in self-defense but expressed a desire to end his life on death row. For more than a decade, Warno's lived on death row at the Florida Department of Corrections, Broward Correctional Institution, BCI. His legal appeals were denied and his behavior became increasingly erratic. He accused prison staff of rigging his food and subjecting him to psychological torment in an attempt to drive him to suicide. In his final moments before his execution on October 9, 2002, Warno's uttered chilling last words. "Yeah, I'd just like to say I'm sailing with the Rock and I'll be back like Independence Day with Jesus, June the 6th, like in the movie, The Big Mothership and all that. I'll be back, I'll be back." These words hinted at a belief in an afterlife or reincarnation, leaving a haunting and lasting impression. The story of Ang Warnos remains one of the most disturbing and perplexing chapters in the annals of American criminal history. His crimes, his tumultuous trial, and his enigmatic final words continue to captivate and unsettle to this day. Patrick Bryan Knight. The name of Patrick Bryan Knight is etched in infamy as a murderer whose heinous crimes rocked Amarillo, Texas in 1991. Born on January 12, 1968, Knight's life took a dark turn on August 27, 1991, when he committed a brutal double murder that would ultimately lead to his execution on June 26, 2007. The victims of Knight's gruesome rampage were Walter Werner, 56, and Marianne Werner, 58. On that fateful day, as the Werners were returning home from work in Amarillo, they had an unexpected and terrifying encounter with Nick and his accomplice, Robert Bradfield. The assailants locked the Werners in their own basement, setting the stage for a nightmarish experience. Knight and Bradfield wasted no time in their quest for cash, commandeering Werner's vehicles to carry out their sinister plans. That night, they bound, gagged, and blindfolded the helpless couple. They then forced Walter and Marianne into their own van and drove them to a remote location in the countryside, far from anyone who might hear their cries for help. In a chilling and ruthless act, Knight forced the Werners to kneel before him before shooting each of them in the back of the head. Their lifeless bodies were dumped in a ditch by the side of the road. Knight callously returned to his trailer, which was located next to the Werner home, and went to sleep, leaving a trail of horror and devastation in his wake. The Werner's disappearance sparked a frantic investigation that led law enforcement to Patrick Knight. Under questioning, Knight confessed to the murders and led authorities to the victims' bodies. His accomplice, Robert Bradfield, was sentenced to two life sentences for his role in the brutal crimes. As Patrick Knight faced the inevitable, he was given the opportunity to make a statement before his execution by lethal injection. In a somewhat disconcerting twist, Knight chose to address the assembled crowd, saying, "I said I was going to tell a joke. Death has set me free. It's the biggest joke ever. I deserve it." His voice shook and he appeared on the verge of tears as he expressed gratitude to God for his friends and made a plea on behalf of the prisoners he believed to be innocent. In a strange twist, Knight also stated, "I am not Patrick Bryan Knight and you cannot stop this execution now. Go ahead, I am finished." Quote. Despite his intentions, Knight's execution was carried out as planned, making it the 18th execution in Texas that year. Randall County Sheriff Joel Richardson, who had witnessed Knight's execution, found his final comments disconcerting and humorless. He noted that Knight's execution brought to an end a 16-year nightmare for the Werner family and emphasized that Knight himself had initiated the horrific ordeal. Patrick Bryan Knight's crimes and haunting last words are a testament to the darkest aspects of human behavior. His execution marked the end of a long and painful chapter for the victims, families, and the Amarillo community, leaving behind a chilling story of violence and loss. Johnny Frank Garrett. The life and death of Johnny Frank Garrett were mired in controversy and allegations of wrongful conviction. Born on the 24th in December 1963, Garrett's story centers on the tragic murder of Sister Thaddeus Benz, a Catholic nun in Amarillo, Texas, on the morning of October 31, 1981. Garrett, then 17 years old, was accused of this heinous crime. According to the indictment, on that fateful morning, Garrett raped, strangled, and killed 76-year-old Sister Thaddeus Benz inside the San Francisco convent. Garrett lived across the street from the convent, which increased suspicions surrounding him. On November 9, 1981, he was arrested and charged with the murder of Sister Thaddeus Benz. Garrett faced trial and was ultimately convicted of the crime. He was incarcerated in the North Hansville Unit, a facility that housed the state's death row inmates. Originally scheduled to be executed on January 6, 1992, Garrett's case took an unusual turn when Pope John Paul II announced the death penalty. Two appealed for clemency. In response to this appeal, Texas Governor Ann Richards granted Garrett a temporary parole. However, this delay in his execution did not ultimately save him from death row. The Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles subsequently held a hearing to determine whether Garrett's death sentence should be commuted to life in prison. Despite arguments raised by his supporters, including a diagnosis of multiple personality due to the abuse he suffered from his family, the death sentence was upheld by a vote of 17-1. On February 15, 1992, at a hearing before the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles, Garrett was sentenced to death. On February 11, 1992, at the age of 28, Johnny Frank Garrett was executed by lethal injection at the Hansville unit. The last meal he ever asked for was a simple meal, ice cream. Although official Texas Department of Criminal Justice records indicated that Garrett declined to make a final statement, and it has been reported that he was quoted as saying his last words at the time of his execution. These widely quoted words were, "I would like to thank my family for loving me and taking care of me. The rest of the world can kiss my ass." Quote, the case of Johnny Frank Garrett continues to be a subject of controversy and debate, with claims of his innocence persisting even after his execution. Director Jesse Quackenbush's documentary The Last Ward argued that Garrett was rightfully convicted due to overzealous prosecutors and inadequate legal representation. This compelling and disturbing story was also adapted into the semi-fictional horror film, The Last Ward of Johnny Frank Garrett, further fueling debates about the justice system and the possibility of wrongful executions. Jeffrey David Matthews. Jeffrey David Matthews was a convicted murderer facing execution in Oklahoma for his role in a heinous crime. Born on September 28, 1972, his life ultimately led him to death row due to a tragic incident that occurred on January 27, 1994. Matthews and an accomplice named Tracy Derrier committed a brutal crime that shocked the community. On that fateful day, they broke into Matthews' great-uncle, Otis Earl Short, 77, of Ross Hill, Oklahoma, was shot dead in the head by a Ruger .45 caliber pistol. Simultaneously, Dyer attacked Otis Short's wife, Minnie Short, slashing her throat. The men fled the scene in Tiz Short's pickup truck after stealing $00 in cash and a .32 caliber pistol from the residence. Tragically, Minnie Short survived the attack but died of natural causes. The investigation into this gruesome crime led to the discovery of crucial evidence. The murder weapon, the .45 caliber Roger pistol used to kill Otis Short, was found buried in a field behind Matthews' home. Additionally, investigators found a vial of Xanax in Matthews' home that had been prescribed to Minnie Tracy Derrier, who initially pleaded guilty to first-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison without charge. The possibility of parole played a pivotal role in the case. He testified against Matthew at the first trial. However, in 1996, Derry recanted his testimony. After Matthews' case was overturned on appeal, he ruled in favor of Matthews at the retrial, affirming Matthews' innocence. Despite Dyer's change of testimony, the outcome was the same and Matthews was reconvicted. Matthews' legal battles continued for years with multiple appeals and attempts to challenge his conviction. However, the lengthy process ultimately did not prevent his execution. On January 11, 2011, Jeffrey David Matthews, 38, was executed by lethal injection at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAlester, Oklahoma. He addressed his family and witnesses with his final words, thanking them for their support and acknowledging his fellow death row inmates. His final words also contained a touch of humor as he commented that the governor had not yet called him. Matthew was pronounced dead at 180.09 hours. The Jeffrey Matthews case, like many death penalty cases, raised questions about the criminal justice system, the appeals process, and the use of capital punishment in the United States. If you enjoy watching interesting stories like this one, be sure to click on the video that appears on your screen to continue exploring the world of crime and the individuals who leave you speechless. No.